Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to update us on research into whether there's any intelligent life on Earth. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob can translate complex scientific concepts into terms that you can understand, that I can understand. It's exciting stuff. I love having Bob here. He is an astronomy, the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and a contributor to Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He knows what he's talking about. The number to call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can check in with us on Twitter at WAMC Vox Pop or on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. And again, the phone number, 800-348-2551. Mr. Bob, welcome back, sir. How are you?
Thank you. Great to be here, Ray. Thanks.
So the solstice is now past.
Yes. Yes, it was the earliest solstice of our lives. We haven't had the start to summer that early since 1896. So it was great. Summer's great. Bring it on.
Why is it earlier this year?
Has to do with our calendar, to make our calendar jibe with the with our orbit around the sun. There's a bunch of tweaks. We know about one of them, that is skipping a leap year every four having a leap year every 4 years. But at the end of every century, then we do insert it, except every 400 years we skip that, and we just did that tweak in the year 2000. So because of that, this is a bit of arcana.
Yeah, how did they figure that out?
That that the solstices and equinoxes are slipping earlier and earlier and earlier as the century went on. Many of us remember when spring started on March 21st.
Yeah.
It hasn't been March 21st for about 15 years now. It's March 20th always, and it's going to even be March 19th by later in the century. And we just had our first June 20th solstice instead of June 21st. So this was, again, very, very early start to summer. Very cool.
Yeah. Let's go right to the phones. And Peggy in Queenman's Hollow. Hi, Peggy. You're on with Bob Berman.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a very simple, stupid question for you.
Oh, I'm sure it's not a stupid question.
The Earth's orbit tends to change. It goes from elliptical to more circular and vice versa. Why? I would assume it would be steady state once it came more toward the circular.
Yes. It's a combination of all the other planets influencing us, and it's a kind of resonance that goes on and on and on, really pretty much forever. We have three things that happen as we go around the sun. We go from a more circular to more elliptical and back again in a period that's over 100,000 years. It takes a long time. We have our axis. That's the thing that gave us the solstice, the northern axis pointing toward the sun. That wobbles around relative to the sun in 21,000 years and relative to the stars in 25,780 years, and we have the axis going, getting more steep and less steep, ranging from about 22 to 24 degrees, and that happens in a 41,000 year period. So all these three things are actually act together. That's what Milutin Milankovitch, I love that name,
yeah.
Milutin Milankovitch, this was a Serb astronomer going back almost a century, who said that all three together give us ice ages. That the glaciation periods, the big changes of our weather are due to all these factors. And right now, all three are acting in a very moderating way so that we're not going to have another ice age again. Even if it weren't for global warming, it's not due for another 100,000 years, which is a big change.
Oh, that's good.
We used to think only a few decades ago that we're finishing up our warm period, the Holocene period that we're in now, and we're going to start to head toward another ice age. And now the thinking is, thanks to these changes, which you just brought up in your question, it's at least 100,000 years naturally before we start getting cold again.
Very interesting. Peggy, thanks for starting us off.
Okay, thank you.
800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest, 1-800-348-2551. Nancy in Tivoli. Nancy, you're on.
Okay. Ray, this is funny. You started the program, and I believe you said twice, is there any intelligent life on Earth?
Yes, it was a wisecrack, Nancy.
Oh, it was, and I thought you meant Alan, you, Bob Berman, and me were the only intelligent life on Earth. So anyway, it was a good wisecrack, and you know I adore you, so that was funny.
You're very kind.
Okay.
Do you have a question for Bob?
No, unfortunately, I can't think of one quickly. I just caught that. Is there any intelligence? And I was so busy laughing, I didn't get my question together. So I'll try to, and I'll call back.
Thanks, Nancy. I appreciate it very much. You know, the reason I made the wisecrack is that Bob and I were talking while the news was on, and we were Bob, you had brought up the fact that you've seen some shows about cosmology, the study of the universe, right? The study of everything.
Right, right.
You know. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but what everyone wants to know, the normal person out there, is there any intelligent life out in the universe? We want to know if we are alone or not alone. That's why I made the wise.
Right, right. And that is kind of a basic question. I've always found that a little bit, slightly on the superficial side.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Of course we want company, and we don't just want to know there's intelligence. We don't want to meet aliens that'll just be smart but stare at us and not say a word. We want conversation. We don't even have this with our dogs and cats. We want someone who can speak to us in an intelligent way, maybe give us some clues, cures to cancer, who knows what. But that would be a wonderful thing for us to encounter, so it's totally understandable. And we've been changing our thoughts about that just since I studied this stuff in school. We're talking about a few decades ago. We used to think that Earth was really an island Earth and that life started independently on Earth. But now that we've discovered all the amino acids among the nebulae of space, and we found that comets and meteorites can bring in amino acids, especially glycine, but others as well, from space. Now we're starting to think that, and once we saw that a bacterium, a streptococcus, lived on the moon alive for 2.5 years. We didn't deliberately
deposited
put it
by,
there, by the Surveyor spacecraft. And when Apollo 12 hopped over to it, the people snipped a little bit of the foam from the cameras and brought it back on Earth. We found that this living bacterium was still alive after 2.5 years in the vacuum of space in those broiling temperatures. We realized that, hey, maybe hidden in the crevices on meteorites or asteroids, since we already have the building blocks of life and the amino acids. And so now we're thinking that maybe that panspermia idea, that life is seeds, the cosmos can travel for millions of years, perhaps as seeds or as incipient simple life forms waiting to spring into life if the conditions are right. And if that's the case, well, then it's not far-fetched at all that we should find life elsewhere. But the reason that it may go deeper than that is that going back two books of mine, not the last one, The Sun's Heartbeat, which I thank you for the plug.
It's coming out in paperback if you're scoring at home.
But
yes.
The one before that, which I did with Bob Lanza, a medical doctor and researcher, and he and I both feel that this is going to sound weird. I shouldn't get too weird too quick on these programs.
Oh, by all means. I've got an hour. Go ahead.
Is that it's not that the universe is this dumb, inert object out there. It's that, as John Wheeler, Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said, that nothing is an actual object until it's observed.
Right.
That quantum theory tells us that electrons and other objects only exist in a kind of probability state and only collapse. They have their wave function collapse to become actual objects in actual places upon observation. And the bottom line to that is that our consciousness, which is very mysterious, the universe itself, as we are observing it, may not be truly independent of us, and that the external universe, nature, and the observer are correlative. We go together. We're part of a single entity.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is the case, just even if somebody will allow that, well, maybe that's the case, that it all goes together, then life, there may not be a place that really is not, in a sense, alive. It's not that we're looking for life amidst the stones and the cold, you know, dead things. It could be that there's no place that you look that isn't a form of...
That's well and good, and perhaps you are correct. But still, getting back to my original point, superficial though it may be, we want to know if there is another intelligent being out there. And right now, for all the Drake equations and for all the postulations, there is no proof that there is.
That's right. So where would we start looking first? Well, we'd start with life began on Earth in the seas. So we'd want to look for water. Our bodies are two-thirds water. Our brains are made of water. And so, you know, life as we know it, that's the typical phrase, life as we know it. Well, the life as we know it is very water-based. So let's start with water. And until just 15 years ago, we didn't know of any water. We knew of H2O. Because it exists in the solid form as ice for over 400 degrees throughout the universe. The rings of Saturn are ice. Comets are balls of ice.
And it's water ice?
And it's water ice. And steam, well, steam surrounds most stars. Most stars are cool red stars, and they have clouds of steam around them. Comets' tails are water vapor. So we see lots of ice and vapor. The question is liquid water. And that's a rare thing because not only does it only exist for a narrow 180-degree range, but it only exists under pressure. So in places like Mars that occasionally has the right temperature, it's right. warm enough, you still can't have water because you need some pressure to let it exist.
So
now, here on Earth,
pressure.
Our atmosphere supplies the pressure. And once you reduce the pressure, it doesn't want to be water anymore. All you have to do is drive up a hill, and every 500 feet higher you go, lowers the boiling point by 1 degree. So that water is more and more willing to not be a liquid anymore and become gas. Just by driving up a hill, it'll boil away a lot faster. By the time you get to Mount Everest, it's down to a boiling at 160 degrees. You can't even get a cup of hot coffee or hot tea there. By the time you're at Denver, you're now 10 degrees lower than you would be, the coffee and the tea would be in Boston or New York City.
Yeah.
So it's the liquid form is very, very rare.
What?
Plus, water shouldn't even be a liquid because it's such a lightweight molecule. It's mostly hydrogen. And other molecules of its size and weight, like methane or hydrogen sulfide, are all gases.
All right, well, let's talk about methane when we come back from the break. And maybe is there a possibility of life in methane, and we'll talk about one of the moons of Saturn, correct?
Yes.
All right, we'll do that after the break. If you want to jump in, 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551. More coming up.
Support for Vox Pop comes from NBT Bank, offering personal banking, financial planning, commercial and business banking, nbtbank.com, member FDIC. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. David Stein and Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Cosmetic dentistry, including Invisalign, where teeth can be orthodontically moved without braces. DavidSteinDDS.com. PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York, presenting Alicia Spiegel's Klezmer Fiddle Express with Patrick Farrell on accordion, Sunday, June 24th at 2 p.m., ps21chatham.org. And Sundog Solar at Sulaqua Power and Art, Chatham, New York. Making power from sunlight, spin your meter backwards. Solar electric and solar hot water sales and leasing, spray foam and cellulose insulation. SundogSolar.net.
The problem with this program, with Bob's appearance, is that I come up with half-form questions here during the break, and I only remember part of what I have seen to generate the question. So a whole line of the program that I intended to go just a few moments ago is now gone. But methane, one of the moons of Saturn. Now, they believe, in the last week or two I saw this news, liquid pools of methane on the surface.
Right. That we know because we actually sent that lander, that Huygens lander, a few years ago, and it did find lakes of methane. And we're thinking, well, could there be methane-based life? Now, methane is CH4. There's no oxygen involved. I don't see. See, oxygen is a very reactive substance. This is something that loves to mate with everything else, and the life on Earth involves oxygen. Now, although there are anaerobic bacteria that can live without being in an oxygen environment or taking in oxygen, so who knows. But still, the first place I would look would be the fantastic discoveries of pools of real water. It has to be under pressure, and we found it in two places now.
Oh, yeah?
Under the surface, under the ice sheets of the smallest Jovian satellite of the four major satellites, Europa. And this one actually has at least a mile thick. But under that, that mile of ice provides the pressure for there to be oceans of not just liquid water, but warm water, salty water. Just exactly what we have in the oceans here. And if life started here, we also possibly had a heads up, a little hand up from the incoming comets and asteroids. Well, so has Europa, because the Jovian system pulls in more asteroids and comets than we do. So it's had billions of years of seeding with the amino acids. It has warm saltwater oceans. Boy, does that look like a place that, if you don't find life there, where are you going to find it? That would be the place for it. And we've also found that Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn, has geysers of water blasting into space and turning into little chunks of ice. So, yes, the obvious methane, the CH4 in the liquid form that we have on Titan is nice. But sure, we look for the closer. Jupiter's only about half the distance to Saturn, and there's warm water ocean, so you'd certainly start there.
So on Europa, is there evidence of tectonic activity or volcanism? So in other words, you know, down at the deepest part of our oceans, there is this whole other life cycle developed around these vents, these hot vents, and, you know, they say these tuber-like things or whatever could be a possibility on a place like Europa if there was volcanic activity.
Right, because what you're saying, Ray, is you're looking for energy. Where's the energy source? Now, just the fact that the water is liquid shows there's energy, and Europa gets it tidally because it gets stretched. You see, the four big moons of Jupiter go around like a marching band. They go in sync. The closest one, Io, goes around four times in the same amount of time that Europa goes around two times, and Ganymede goes around once.
Hmm.
So they meet up at every single orbit. They get pulled again. They get pulled and stretched. Plus, they're stretched by mighty Jupiter. Jupiter has 318 times the mass of Earth. So it's pulling on these poor bodies and deforming them and stretching them, and this produces the heat.
Ah.
So it's got its built-in undersea source of heat. So the creatures there automatically have it made.
All right. Well, that's good to know. James in Saratoga. James, you're on. You got to turn your radio down a little bit, James.
Okay, how's that?
Good.
All right. This, again, might sound like a stupid question, but in my mind, for many years, I've always thought that the moon was not really a satellite of the Earth, meaning it seemed to be another object in an interweaving orbit around the sun with the Earth, and that the Earth didn't really have the mass by itself to keep an object the size of the moon in its own orbit. Now, that's probably completely wrong, and it sounds like a stupid question, but is there anything that you've ever heard or read that the moon actually travels around the sun with the Earth in kind of an interweaving orbit? That make any sense?
Well, yes, that's true, but it's also a satellite of ours. And it's true in the sense, this is a fascinating thing, that if you plotted out the moon's path around the sun, most of us in our minds think of as the moon is going around the Earth, plus the Earth and the moon are going around the sun. What would be, if you remove the Earth, what is the moon's path? We'd think of it as maybe a series of little curlicues around things. But because of the actual speeds involved, the moon's path is always close to a straight line. It's always concave to the sun. It never gets convex at any point.
Wow.
So in that sense, it's a double body going around the sun. But it would be wrong to say it's not a full satellite, regardless of how it got captured, whether it was a result of a collision, which is what we think is probable, between a Mars-sized body, maybe 4-point-something billion years ago, hitting us. Nonetheless, we weigh 81 times more than the moon does, and that's plenty of a ratio, enough of a ratio for us to be the top dog in the system and for the moon to completely go around us. Here's another way of telling. In a two-body system where both of them are almost the same mass, let's say Pluto and its moon Charon, the two of them only have a 2-to-1 size ratio, and so they don't even orbit, Charon doesn't even orbit around Pluto. They both orbit around one spot in space, a blank spot between them.
And oh,
so that would be
like a seesaw.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And in fact, all bodies do that. They orbit around their gravitational balancing point called the Barry Center. Even Jupiter going around the sun doesn't really go around the sun. It goes around a blank spot in space outside the sun's surface, where both the sun and Jupiter both make a swing around this every 11.86 years. But that doesn't happen with our moon and us. It orbits around us, and the balancing point, the barycenter of the Moon-Earth system, is 1,000 miles below the surface of Earth, always in the direction from Earth's center toward the Moon. So we do make this one wobble around the spot 1,000 miles below our surface in the direction of the Moon. We make this wobble every 27.32166 days reliably, and the Moon orbits not the center of Earth, but this spot 1,000 miles below. Nonetheless, it is below our surface. And therefore, we can truly say, yes, the moon is orbiting Earth.
All right, James.
Thank you for putting that to rest for me. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. So what happens then in the case where there are many moons, like a Jupiter? You said they perform as a marching band.
Yes.
So
yes.
How does this work when there are so many satellites?
Yes. In the case of Jupiter, though, the masses of the moons are so low compared to, because Jupiter is so massive. As I said, it has the weight of 318 Earths. So in that case, there's not much confusion. But in the case of the planets around the sun, there is, because Saturn is a heavyweight object. It weighs 95 Earths. Yeah. Jupiter, as we said, weighs 318 Earths. As they tug on the sun is being yanked one way and then another. And when both Saturn and Jupiter in particular are on the same side, they can really pull the sun by more than one sun width away from its normal position. So when we look at the sun in the sky, we'd say, well, where should the sun be? It's not always where we think it should be. Sometimes it's a whole sun width yanked off to the side, thanks to Jupiter and Saturn combined. Well, when the two are on opposite sides of the solar system in their orbits, then they kind of counteract each other, and then the sun's wobble is a little less. And you know, Ray, that's exactly how we're detecting other planets in extrasolar planets.
The wobble.
By the wobble of the star.
Interesting. Let's go to Wayne in Lenox. Wayne.
Yes.
You're on.
Other than our sun, if I'm correct, the next star is four light years away.
That's right, 4.22 light years.
Okay, now, every other star then is even further away, and it takes longer for the light to reach Earth.
Right.
My question is, if the light on the closest star left in 2008, how do we know that everything else hasn't disappeared?
Well, it could have, because whenever we're speaking of observing anything, even each other, we're always talking about acting as if the light arriving is the current event. We don't factor that in. In truth, light requires a foot. It travels a foot of distance in a nanosecond, in a billionth of a second. So when you're looking at something 10 feet away, you're seeing it as it was 10 nanoseconds, 10 billionths of a second in the past. Our GPS satellites use this. When you're driving your car and it's trying to figure out where you are on the Earth, it's getting time signals from three or more satellites, and the time is always wrong. And it knows the time is wrong because it took time for the light, these radio signals travel at the speed of light, to arrive at your Camry from the satellite, which is 11,000 miles up. And it's wrong by about a 20th of a second. It uses the known speed of light to say, well, how far must that satellite be to have this wrong time, this delay in the time signal, because your unit in your car knows the exact right atomic clock time. That's how they're built. And it,
so
does,
I correct?
It does this with three or more satellites, and it triangulates, and that's how it knows where you are.
So am I correct that the light that we see from the nearest star is the light that was emitted back in 2008?
That's exactly right. Yes, yes. And although these things could have disappeared, the fact that stars typically live for billions of years, what are the chances that it's ceased to exist in the 4 years that its light was en route to us when its lifespan is billions of years? In fact, I once did the math for all the 6,000 visible stars in the night sky, and it winds up being only one chance in 200 that any of the stars aren't there anymore. That even one of them isn't, it has blown up and isn't, we're not really seeing it. So although it's possible what you're saying, the likelihood is that they're all there just because they live so long.
Wow.
Okay, very good.
The most amazing, 800-348-2551, the telephone number, 800-348-2551. The most interesting thing about what you just said was that you actually took the time to figure that out.
I have deadlines and I'm supposed to write stuff every month, so...
You know, and there have been cases, many cases, right, where there have been supernovae, and we watch them, but they happened years and years ago.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
1-800-348-2551. So the new book is coming out in paperback. It went pretty well in hardback.
That's right. In hardcover, the sun's heartbeat.
Yeah.
And in fact, this is a great time for the sun because we've had the transit. We're going to have a great solar eclipse coming up in November. We didn't have any this year, for the last year. And so it's the greatest event that the eye can see. I'm always a little sorry that people, all of us, have witnessed lunar eclipses. We've witnessed in our lives partial solar eclipses.
Yeah.
And all these things are, to be honest, interesting, but they're not life-changing. They're not things that make you cry, make people weep or make sounds. But a total solar eclipse, which is very rare, it only happens every 360 years for any given spot on Earth, that makes animals act up and makes people weep, and that's the great
event.
There's something that happens, Ray, when the sun and the moon and your spot on Earth form a straight line, when the moon's shadow, which tapers like a chopstick and it gets narrower and narrower and just goes to where you're standing, because it tapers to almost nothing by the time it hits Earth, which is why the places to see it are just such a tiny part of Earth.
Yeah.
For example, the coming one, it'll be total from Cairns, Australia, and essentially nowhere else on Earth. So that's where you have to go. In fact, I'd love to have some people from our listening area come. We have a tour group going.
You're going.
We just got three cancellations of the 40 people. Hey, people can look up Berman Astronomy or Berman Astronomy Tours. Come and join us for this amazing eclipse in Australia. It's the greatest thing the eye can see. You know, it changes people's lives, and afterward, people are always scheming. All right, what do I have to do to get under the moon shadow the next time? People think about second jobs and second mortgages,
nice,
and whatever it takes, because it's that life changing. You know, Mark Twain and Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Remember, he had his hero predicting an eclipse, and then all the natives worshipped him,
yeah,
and they let him go, and it saved his life. And you see why these amazing fictional and real events happen. There's just nothing like it.
How was the transit of Venus? As a matter of fact, let's go to Morel now in Barrytown, because Morel is going to talk about the transit of Venus. You're on Vox Pop. Hello.
Hi, I'm Noel.
Oh, Noel. I'm sorry.
Noel, as in
says,
Christmas.
Says Morel, I promise you. But welcome aboard.
Well, hi. Ever since the transit of Venus, I've had things breaking, going haywire, a little crash with the car, nothing terrible. Nothing, but does that kind of celestial phenomenon have any impact on how stuff happens here on Earth? Because computer, and I'm not the only one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've talked about this with other people.
Transits of Venus are famous for wrecking technology. In the 2004 transit, there was a lot of people had to bring their computers
really?
In to be fixed.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Just the fact that the Venus crossing the face of the sun and being a little tiny dot on the sun changes around all the circuitry on Earth. It's just
he's being a wise guy.
Yeah, I'm being a wise guy. No, it's just a little.
I'm gullible.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's, but you know,
it sounded believable.
But here's what happened.
It's me having a bad week.
It's you having a bad week. But this is a very well-known phenomenon. I have to tell you that what you're talking about, because whenever there is an event, we humans link occurrences with other occurrences. That's what we do. We always look for patterns. For example, if the phone rings all week long, every time you just sit down for dinner, this isn't going to escape our attention. We're going to notice it. So when you have an event, it could be a lunar eclipse or it could be a transit or something, and then something happens in your life, especially if it happens to a few people, we link it. That's what we do. That's what statistics are for.
So it's okay then. It'll be all right.
It's all right. Yeah, and besides, you know what? If you just keep eating those health foods and you wait till the next transit in 2117, see if it happens again next time.
All right, I'll check it out.
Hey, Noel, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
You know, really, when the phone rings every day when I'm sitting down at dinner, I know that it's a political poll. That's what happens in my house. So there's nothing really mysterious about that. Bill in Rosendale. Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Bob, I have a question about dark matter and antimatter.
Sure.
What's the difference? How do we know they're there? And what do we know about them other than the fact that they're there, if anything?
Okay, well, two very different things, although they both have the word matter in it, of course. Antimatter is a real substance. We can manufacture it. In fact, the world's output of antimatter is about 1 microgram a year. It's produced. Mm-hmm. And antimatter is just ordinary matter, except with the electrical charges reversed. You know how every atom has a positively charged nucleus, proton, surrounded by a negatively charged electron? Well, antimatter is exactly the same thing. The nucleus is precisely the same, except it has a negative charge, and the electron has a positive charge, called a positron. That's what Data's brain was.
In Star Trek.
In Star
the
Trek,
next
he had a positronic brain.
Understood.
And it's not science fiction because we use that. For example, a PET scan, the P in PET scan, is positrons. So these antimatter things are created, and as they change form from antimatter, that's what's detected and used for probing your body.
Wow.
So it's an actual application, and it's a real
all
thing.
Right, so that's antimatter.
That's antimatter.
And we create them by reversing polarities?
You know, I don't know the technical, the way. Well, that's what we do, but how it's actually technically created in a way that makes it, not too expensive, where it can actually be done in PET scan machines, I don't know. It's a good question. I'm going to look it up myself. And dark matter, though, totally different thing. We don't know what it is. It's mysterious. And it was first theorized in 1933 when Fritz Zwicky noticed that clusters of galaxies, like the one we're in, a group of about 30 galaxies, were glued together. And he realized that from the speed that the Milky Way and Andromeda and the other members have, we shouldn't be hanging out. We're moving so fast, we should escape from the gravitational clutches of the collective, of the Borg collective. We shouldn't be here. We should be out of here. But we're not. And so, well, it must mean we've got a lot more stuff, mass, gravity. And so he and others since then, since 1933, have added up all the stars, all the nebulae, all the conceivable black holes. You see, there can't be too many of them because they locally affect the motion of stars. So there's a limit on how many they can be. And adding up everything we can think of, there's still 6 times too little mass to supply the gravity that we see that's holding these, not just our own local group of galaxies, but all clusters of galaxies have such motions that they ought to have dissipated and gone their separate
unless they
ways,
don't know,
and they haven't.
Unless they don't know everything about gravity, though, right? Could there not be another aspect to it?
That's such a smart thing you're saying, Ray. That's an amazing thing you're
saying. Well, that's a great spot to take a break. Bill, you know, I've been complimented.
Speaking of, why does that not call our understanding of mass and its attraction to itself?
Well, that's the thing. That's the other alternative, is that gravity falls off in a strange way that we never knew about.
Right.
Instead of falling off inversely with the square of distance, maybe as you get really far away and gravity gets weak, it has unsuspected properties. And there are researchers looking into that, and so far it's been negative, and very few astronomers think that's the case. So the alternative to gravity being weird is that there is some kind of substance that can't be seen, that doesn't bond with anything, that has no form, but does exert a gravitational pull. And that mysterious thing is called dark matter.
Interesting.
Okay.
Bill, we're overdue for a break, so I'm going to let you go. I appreciate it very much. The phone number to call is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. And he's made 3 Star Trek references already. So set your phasers on stun for the home stretch. 800-348-2551. More coming up.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available. TheDamCafeAndDeli.com. Schenectady Museum and Planetarium presenting NASA's Driven to Explore exhibit July 12th and 13th only. SchenectadyMuseum.org. Thiel Group, Latham, New York, a business consulting sales and acquisition firm helping business owners achieve their dreams when buying, selling, or growing their business. THIEL Group.com. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering care and service to area seniors since 1975, independent living, memory care, and more. Caring in the family tradition. 518-393-8800. And Isn't It Sweet, Albany, New York, soft serve ice cream cakes, chocolate dip strawberries, handmade chocolates, weeknights till 8 p.m. and Sundays. 518-489-9820.
One 800 348 2551 is our telephone number. It is Vox Pop. Bob Berman makes his way here about once a month or so, and we're always happy to have him here talking about all sorts of stuff. You know, we get into cosmology, and it invariably comes down to two things. One, how did the universe start, or did it start, which I cannot wrap my mind around it not having a beginning. And, you know, the other thing is, does it end?
Right.
And I guess if it doesn't end, it never began.
That's a problem. If it's infinite, which more and more evidence is pointing to, that would mean that if it had a beginning, it had to begin as infinite from the beginning. It began as infinite.
Yeah.
There's no other way around it. And unfortunately, with logic, if we picture a beginning, we'll automatically, like the Big Bang, we'll ask, well, how did that happen and what happened before that?
Yeah.
And if there is no beginning, if it's eternal, the way Aristotle thought, and which is looking more and more like the reality, I'd say the smart money should bet on an infinite and eternal universe. Certainly that's where the evidence has been pointing since about late 1990s. Well, then you also have something that's not, that we can't picture. One of the problems is that all the TV shows on cosmology, a lot of them narrated by, like everything else in life, by Morgan Freeman, present ideas because there's a lot of competition between cosmologists. Many have books that they want published.
Sure.
Or they want publicity.
Yeah.
And so you come up with ideas like brains, B-R-A-N-E-S, which are membranes that may have collided to produce the Big Bang. Or multiverses, the idea that there's many different universes out there simultaneously. And the real problem right now, Ray, is that the actual hard data that we have is almost negligible. We have so little data that you can sink your teeth into. We
yeah.
know what the cosmic microwave background is. We know what the Hubble constant is, how fast things are receding. And thanks to this new survey by a Berkeley team of 900,000 galaxies, for the first time we're getting a sense of the larger scale structure of things. And it's showing us that space has a flat topology. It doesn't curve. And if it doesn't curve, that indicates an infinite universe.
Right.
So although you can't ever prove infinity, all the separate data are now pointing toward an infinite universe. And the problem with that is we can't picture infinity. And I guess what I'm saying is that there's a big dichotomy, there's a big split between what the TV shows are saying, Stephen Hawking and all the rest, that are presenting ideas as if we have a good handle.
Yeah.
On the universe. When the truth is, and astrophysicists know that this is the truth, but you can't get a TV show to say it because what sponsor is going to pay to have somebody say, I don't know. We really don't know if the universe was born. We don't know what it's made of. We certainly know that 96% of the universe is dark matter and dark energy, and those are utterly unknown. So the observable universe, we only know about 4%. And now,
unless it's infinite.
Right. And that 4%, even the observable universe, is now starting to look like it's only 0% of the larger universe, because any percentage of infinity is zero.
Right.
So what we can see, we only know 4% of, and what we can see is 0% of the larger structure. Now, I don't have to tell listeners that when you have a sample size of 0%, your conclusions are just not that trustworthy. So we have models. You know, in science, everything is model dependent. I was just speaking with my friend Tarun Biswas, who's a physics professor at SUNY New Paltz, about this. And models just means we look at nature, we make observations, and we draw models or pictures about it. That's fine. That's how science works. The problem with cosmology is that because the data is so skimpy right now, so negligible, our models are very tentative. They're early models. We're going to have to revise them. We're going to have to change almost everything. And so that nothing that we say today and nothing that we have in our heads is likely to prove true in 10 years, let alone 50 years, let alone a century from now. So I would caution in all these TV shows, and we get a lot of calls and letters at Astronomy Magazine about this, don't take this stuff too seriously. We're really in our infancy, and the truth is we don't know what the universe is made of. We don't know if it was born. We don't know how far it extends. We don't know the future. And these are the bedrock questions. These are the ones that any child is likely to ask their parents about the universe. And any honest cosmologist will say, we don't know.
Well, hell, I can say that. Maybe I can get a show on Discovery Channel. Dave in Monroe, you're on. Dave.
Yeah, it's Jim, not Dave.
Well, we're batting 1,000 on the screening department here. Jim, welcome.
I have a question about time, because for some reason I just can't get a handle on my head that there's an actual thing called time, and it's just not an explanation of a cosmic thing that we really don't understand.
Well, you know what? You're not alone, because there's very few physicists today, unlike perhaps 30 years ago, who believe that time actually exists. And we've always been suspicious of it, because time does not have a place in Newton's laws, in Einstein's relativity, for example. If you use the field equations of general relativity, time does not figure in there. And we're more and more suspicious that time is not an actual thing, but rather just a way that we animals make sense of the world. We're always getting bombarded with sensory data, electrical impulses in our brain. There's just tons of them, and so we structure them, we order them, we sequence them. And this is what really time is. In other words, it's a tool of animal perception. It's not an actual thing out there. You can't take time to a laboratory. You can't analyze it like a piece of quartz or a piece of cheddar cheese. And so I think you're absolutely right, Jim. Time does not exist as an actual thing in the universe. It goes with us. It goes with us as an as observers.
I know that we have 9 minutes left in the show, if that's helping you at all. Dave, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry.
Yes, good afternoon, Bob, and good afternoon, Ray.
Hello.
Hi.
In going back to your discussion about intelligent life elsewhere in the universe and how people, most of us, would like to interact with a species that we could communicate with or learn something from, I'm wondering what is the, for lack of a better phrase, practical application of pursuing this sort of venture? Because if there were a race that were similar to what we're looking for, as I just described, it could be so far away that the only way we could do it is by sending out a huge spaceship with a colony on it that could sustain itself for generations or centuries. And by the time they made such a discovery, they wouldn't necessarily feel any connection or obligation to us anymore to report back. And if so, it would take years and years at the speed of light.
Well, you're absolutely right. If we should find intelligent life, let's say really close to us, in an unlikely way, let's say 20 light years away from us, and if we ever get the capacity to travel at 1% of the speed of light, which would be pretty darn good. Right now, our fastest rockets are about 10 miles per second. And to travel at 1% of the speed of light, we'd have to go 1,800 miles per second. So we have to increase our speed more than 100-fold. But let's say we were able to do that. Still, that would mean that
that would be 2,000 years, right? 100 times 20.
Yep, you're quick. That's right. In fact, I was just scribbling that on a piece of paper. I had to do that on a piece of paper, what you just did in your head. Yeah, it would be 2,000 years to make the trip, 2,000 years back. So in practice, we'd send them radio waves because that travels at the speed of light. And let's say we found a way to communicate. We'd say, hey, how are you? And then 20 years later, they'd get it. And let's say they responded that afternoon, sent us back a message. Hey, we're fine. What's happening? That would be another 20 years to get here. So in other words, 40 years would have elapsed between our hello and the reply of, oh, hi, how are you? And we'd send the next message like that. So it would be a kind of an awkward, long gaps between that. And perhaps eventually over many lifetimes, we would pack people into spacecraft. 2,000-year trip, we'd have to have generations and generations of people going there. And we'd have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
What's there? What's there for us? And because, you know, we grew up here at home with this atmosphere, this gravity, the foods that we have. I mean, is there going to be decent pizza there? It's going to be pretty decent, pretty different atmosphere. Everything's going to be different. And different means alien, uncomfortable, dangerous, perilous once you leave Mother Earth. So we'd really have to think about it long and hard whether the advantages would outweigh the disadvantages.
Yeah, and I mean, like right now, the temperature is just like 30 degrees above normal. it's darn uncomfortable.
Yes, it is.
And that's a small variation compared to what we might encounter at another planet that bears intelligent life. So now, would you say your scenario is optimistic? Even I might consider it optimistic.
Oh, that would be way optimistic because the number of stars increases. You know, as you look farther away, you know the volume of any sphere. If you consider something that's twice as far away, you're going to see stars that increase at the rate of, well, the formula for the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r³. So,
oh, yeah.
So you increase with the cube of distance. So once you look twice as far away, we were talking about 20 light years. Now you're looking at 40 light years. You don't have twice as many stars. You have eight times more potential stars. So it keeps getting more and more and more and more. And that's why the most likely place to encounter life or anything else we'd be looking for, the farther you look, the more it increases your chances.
Jerry, we got to go. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. You know, what about the radio search for life? It's been going on since, what, 1960?
And nothing yet.
Nothing definitive, certainly.
And I don't know what to make of that. We could say that perhaps life, even intelligent life, is maybe not into technology. We look around at the other non-human life forms here. Chimps, I just saw an amazing thing that showed that chimps are as good as we are at some intellectual functions, that is, sequencing numbers on a computer screen.
Yeah.
Dolphins, whales, these are intelligent life forms here on Earth that show no inclination to build spacecraft or radios or, you know, leave the planet. And it could be that this thing that we assume that every other civilization is going to go the technological route that we do, and maybe they don't do that at all. Maybe this is very, very rare for intelligent life to do this kind of thing. And so, therefore, the SETI program of looking for life elsewhere requires people to be monitoring radio transmissions. And this may be just not anything that anyone's interested in or that very few are interested in.
You know, it strikes me that if we find one microbe living thing anywhere, then chances are there is intelligent life out there. But until we find one living bacteria or anything.
Right, right.
We're guessing.
That's right. Which is why that, again, Europa is so important, Ray, to get to those warm, salty oceans, which has been seeded with amino acids for billions of years. Earth had life form under similar conditions. And here we have another place really close by, less than an hour away at the speed of light. And this would be the place. I'd almost say it would be surprising not to find life there. So I don't know why that has not become a top priority. There is only one mission that's now been green-lighted to go to Europa. And you know what it's going to do? It's going to orbit because that's cheaper.
Yeah.
Just going to orbit.
Now, what can you learn?
Nothing.
Nothing that you haven't learned already.
No, we're gonna see, get the detection of sodium. We're gonna know, yes. We're gonna confirm, yeah. Those are saltwater oceans, but without drilling or burning our way through that thick ice, or maybe we'll be able to do it because the ice meets other ice, and there's cracks and there's sheets and there's places where actually some of the water bubbles up. So you might be able to kind of probe it without even going under fully under the ice. And until we get a sample of that, nothing else is, or let's put it this way, everything else is just guesswork, just speculation.
Well, that's a great way to end the program. Bob Berman, always wonderful to have you on the program.
Thanks,
we'll see you again next month. The Sun's Heartbeat will be out in paperback soon. Look for that. Support for WAMC comes from the Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond. Noinkyfingers.com. Schoharie Tourism, Schoharie County adventures above and below the ground in upstate. Something unexpected. UpstateVacations.com. I love New York. The American Hotel in Sharon Springs, New York, serving dinner Thursday through Sunday, beginning at 5 p.m. on Sunday, brunch from 8 to 2, and afternoon meals 11:30 to 4. AmericanHotelNY.com. And Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, a gardener's destination featuring trees, shrubs, water garden plants, and many perennials, open Monday through Sunday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.
I love that place, Stories. That's an amazing place, that nursery.
All right, now you're interrupting my underwriting credit
here.
8 a.m. to 5 p.m., storiesnursery.com. Berman, have you ever done this before? Thank you to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Christy Carton answered the phones. Patrick Donjas, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Moyers & Company tomorrow. Next week on Medical Monday, St. Peter's Hospital Chief of Medicine, Dr. Mark Pettis, will join us. Stay tuned now for a news update.